ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, beloved listeners, a new memoir is making waves and getting some great reviews, partly because of its unconventional approach, but mainly because of its poignancy and lyricism. André Dow's Anam pays tribute to his Vietnamese ancestry and to universal questions about identity and about how much we can truly know about other people's lives and the past. The book, well, can be described as autofiction because it's part autobiography and part fiction. André is a legal academic as well as an accomplished writer, and he's currently a postdoctorate research fellow at the Melbourne Law School at the University of Melbourne. Welcome, André, and thanks for coming on the program. Can you give me a brief snapshot of the family's recent history? The facts are known, your grandfather's story first, because, he's so central.
Yes, of course. Well, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be speaking to you. My grandfather was a Catholic intellectual and a lawyer in Vietnam, and I guess the central fact of his life, at least as it became sort of revealed to me when I was a teenager, was that he was imprisoned by the communist government in Vietnam for 10 years without charge or trial. And so really it was that discovery of that fact, a fact that hadn't quite been hidden from me, but which I didn't know or didn't know to ask about when I was young. It was sort of the discovery of that that really spurred on the project that became Anam.
Later we'll discuss how he felt when he came out of that prison term, but you describe him as a broken man, yet he eventually spends the rest of his life in France.
Yes, that's right. So after being released in the late 1980s, he went to France, the former colonizer of Vietnam, but which he and his family had links to, and actually his wife, my grandmother, and their children, including my father, had all fled to France only 3 or 4 years into his imprisonment. So they had actually left him behind, essentially, without knowing whether or not they'd ever see him again.
Seven children, one of them your father, and he moves to Australia to marry his high school sweetheart.
Yes, that's right. So he was already engaged at the time that he left with his family to France. And then my mum separately managed to flee and became one of the so-called boat people, first arriving in Malaysia and then eventually, sort of to her surprise in some ways, being resettled in Australia. And so the idea had been that she would actually join up with my father in France, but that proved impossible. So it ended up being Australia.
So from living, or the idea of living in a suburb of Paris, to living in a suburb of Melbourne.
Yeah, and I guess that's been a part of my own sense of the kind of contingency of becoming Australian, even more so than I guess, I mean, I think most children of refugees would feel that. But in my case, it was a story that I was told often as a child, that if things had turned out slightly differently, you'd be French.
A place providing safety and shelter, if not a sense of belonging. They finish up buying a small red brick house, which is next door to that of a Vietnam War vet.
Yeah, so that was, from my perspective as a kid, they were our kind of kindly neighbours. Anne was a really lovely woman who often looked after my brothers and I, and would come around and spend a lot of time with my parents. Her husband, Paddy, was a bit more of a mysterious figure for us, but I do remember the large portrait of him in his living room in full military gear. And I mean, I never really put those things together until long after he passed away and we'd moved from the area. And I kind of realized that I think, you know, I got my history a bit mixed up and just imagined that he was a World War II veteran, but of course he wasn't. He was a Vietnam War veteran. But it's sort of extraordinary that those connections weren't ever made.
Well, it's explicit. Sort of serendipitous in a way, isn't it? Now, your dad becomes a postman.
Yeah, so he'd actually, along with my mother, they had begun training as lawyers in Vietnam before the end of the war. So they weren't able to continue that after the communist victory. And when he arrived in Australia, that was the work that he could find as a postman.
Now, your grandfather was initially attracted to Ho Chi Minh's particular brand of communism and had, of course, a very strong nationalist elements. But your Vietnamese heritage is complicated, isn't it? Because also within your family are people who fought on the other side with the communists.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's something that it took me a long time to really wrap my head around. I guess from that point when I discovered that my grandfather had been imprisoned by the communist government, you know, that kind of, I felt like that set our family on one side of the war. And really for a long time, I thought I was writing a fairly straightforward story about a man who had become a victim of a repressive government. It was only when I got the chance to speak to him at length and we started to talk about his youth, and he talked to me about the things that he saw as a young man under French colonization and the kind of the racist regime that he lived under, and his yearning for a free and independent Vietnam, and his stories about coming across communist activists who promised this world of justice and freedom. And he talked at length to me about his attraction to those ideals and to that movement. And he actually, for a time, moved towards that side of politics along with his brother. That becomes one of the central threads in the novel, is the way in which those two brothers split apart. And my grandfather didn't continue down that path of communism and instead actually became a Catholic and, you know, became bitterly opposed to the communists.
Of course, Catholicism is an enormous force in Vietnam.
It is. It's still a minority force, but I think that, at least as far as my family are concerned, it really became the guiding force in their lives, spiritually, of course, but also intellectually. And it was really their Catholicism that I think, at least for my grandfather, sort of brought him back to French thinkers and French politics, even though his initial impulse had been to free himself of that influence. So I think that was one of the central mysteries for me as well, was how did this Catholic conversion happen and how was it so strong that it would bring him really to kind of repudiate his earlier yearnings.
Andre, tell me about the impact of Vietnam on you when you visited about 10 years ago.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to go live in Hanoi to do a writing residency there to try and write this story. And I have to say that before going over, I had a fairly naive view of what Vietnam would be. And I think everything sort of changed for me on that trip in terms of how I understood the country. It was much more modern than I had expected. You know, so on the one hand, that I kind of met my peers, young people for whom the war was not even a distant memory, but just something that they read about in textbooks, and they firmly had their eyes set on the future. And at the same time, I met those relatives who had not only stayed behind, but actually had been active participants in the war on the communist side. And for them, you know, that was really the moment that I realized that what I was grappling with was, in a way, multiple versions of the same place. So, yeah.
A family divided. Your relatives must have very different views of Vietnam and of the war.
Absolutely. I mean, I think views doesn't even, it's something even stronger. It's kind of, you know, they really have different senses of reality in a way. So when my family in France recall Vietnam, they recall a place that was just diametrically opposed or existing on a different plane in a way to the Vietnam that my Hanoian relatives were recalling, which is really why in the book I call it Annam, which is to say that the place that I end up writing about is neither entirely the Vietnam that my French relatives were remembering nor the Vietnam that my Hanoian relatives were remembering, but some other place.
What was the attitude there to the experience of boat people?
The surprising thing for me in Hanoi about the question of boat people was largely that it was not understood. I had expected maybe resistance or scorn, but largely most people that I spoke to hadn't thought a lot about the boat people, and the older people who had, I mean, they understood them as having fled or taken the easy way out, but it wasn't at all the kind of burning issue that I had thought it would be. And in fact, being Australian and growing up in Australia, the question of boat people was in many ways much more important here than it was for them.
Back to your grandfather, there's a lot you simply couldn't pin down about him because, of course, you didn't have the advantages that many biographers have of being able to rely on records.
That's right. So I really felt that, like, when I was writing the book, that, you know, other people might be able to go back through historical records or other kinds of documents, but really all I was left with was there was this Amnesty International newsletter that had the details of my grandfather's imprisonment. There were a handful of other tiny bits and pieces from my grandparents' apartment, but largely all I had was what they told me in that apartment, the kind of long conversations I had with them.
One reason that you decided, after agonizing over the book for 12 years, to make it partly fictional.
That was definitely one of the reasons. So there just were so many gaps in what I was able to learn. And then during that time, my grandfather passed away. So it was partly practical, but it was also larger than that, in that I quickly began to see that there was this chasm of experience between us that I wasn't able to bridge with facts. And in particular, I really realized that they were giving me not facts as such, but they were giving me a myth or versions of a myth, and so were my Hanoian relatives, and so were the other books that I was reading about the conflict in Vietnam. And so what I was really dealing with was all these competing stories, myths, and so I had to work out, how do I hold those things together without necessarily privileging one over the other?
I've travelled extensively in Vietnam, but I've never been to that remarkable prison you describe, which was built on the principles of Jeremy Bentham.
Yeah, it is a really incredible mix of philosophies, if you like, between the philosophy of Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian thinker who came up with this idea of the panopticon, where any prisoner was observable from a central tower at any time. And so the idea was that they would come to internalize the guard within their own minds so that they would sort of behave accordingly. So that was one of the principles. But the other was actually drawn from, you know, the Chinese I Ching and the sort of sacred powers of geometry. So you have this incredible mixture of hyper-rationalist thinking, but also deeply supernatural and superstitious thinking as well.
Your parents must have been very wary of what you were doing.
They were, and I think so the rest of my family as well. I think they understood me to be doing something that might have been more in the line of a hagiography of my grandfather, one that might have treated him as a martyr. And that was the more simple story that I had set out to tell at the beginning. But as time dragged on, and I think as I asked stranger questions, then I think that wariness did come in of, on the one hand, when will this book come out? But also, what kind of book is it exactly that you're working on?
But Andre, now it's come out, they must be, well, perhaps even proud of you because it's doing so well.
You know, an extraordinary thing has been happening as the book's come out and the really positive reaction has filtered through to my parents. I've discovered all of a sudden that they've started talking to me more, actually. And I hadn't known how they would react to the book. I wasn't sure. But in the last couple of weeks, they've begun talking to me about stories that I actually haven't even heard before, even through that 12 years of research. And I've been thinking that, you know, I kind of spent that 12 years trying to turn on this or to open this valve, and suddenly it's burst open.
It may require a second edition.
There have been stories that I've thought, oh, that would have been nice to have in the book.
What are some of the things you've learned since the publication?
Well, there's one image in particular that stuck with me over the weekend. My dad was recalling the time immediately after the fall of Saigon, and he was talking about his uncle, so my grandfather's brother-in-law, who had been quite a prominent politician in sort of Catholic circles and anti-communist circles, and he refused to leave, even though he had a ticket to America. He refused to leave his country and sort of essentially drank himself to death in the months following the end of the war. But when that man died, my father remembers that the family were given a coffin that was too small for him. And so my dad was telling me about this image of remembering having to shove his uncle into this coffin that was too small.
Most bizarre. Look, finally, do you see yourself in your grandfather?
I think that is something that I have wondered about. It's something that he said to me, actually, was that he wanted to tell me all of the details of his life so that I wouldn't be too much like him. And I've often tried to wonder what he meant by that. And I think it was in relation to his passionate politics, which led him to much grief in his life. I think he wanted me to try and learn from that. And I think he did see some of the same tendencies in me.
Andre Dow, thanks for coming on. The book is published by Penguin, Hamish Hamilton. Well done.
Thanks, Philip.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.